Historically, thousands of murders are classified as unsolved across the UK. Modern forensic techniques help families find justice even after decades have passed. I'm Winston Clarkson, and I've worked inside the underworld for more than 30 years. Alongside police officers, forensic scientists, and criminals, my research has included prison visits, surveillance operations, police raids, and even postmortems. And now I want to take you on a journey into modern forensic science.
You're listening to the Real Silent Witnesses podcast from Graphic Audio, a podcast series that delves into the scientific leaps in forensics.
In each episode, we'll meet forensic experts and journalists who work tirelessly to help families that deserve answers. And we'll examine the techniques that help solve the most difficult cold cases. Throughout the show, you'll hear extracts from my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses. This is The Real Silent Witnesses, the mysterious deaths of Roberto Calvi and Georgi Markov. Our guest today is forensic pathologist Dr. Stuart Hamilton. Dr. Stuart Hamilton has been a Home Office registered forensic pathologist for many years. He's performed 3,000 autopsies and regularly provides expert opinion on the cause of injuries, both in the living and the dead. Stuart's also authored several books and academic papers, as well as being involved in many true crime TV series, including Britain's Most Evil Killers and Murder Mystery and My Family. He was also series advisor for the BBC drama Silent Witness. With him, we're going to cover the cases of Roberto Calvi and Georgi Markov. These are amongst the most bizarre deaths in recent history. Roberto Calvi was an Italian banker with links to the Vatican Bank, the Mafia, and the Masons. He was found hanging from Blackfriars Bridge in June 1982. His death is a source of enduring controversy and was ruled a murder after two coroner's inquests and an independent investigation. Five people were acquitted of murdering Calvi in Rome in June 2007. Georgi Markov's demise is just as weird. A Bulgarian dissident, he was shot in the leg with a pellet fired from an umbrella wielded by someone associated with the Bulgarian Secret Service. Let's hone in on these cases. Hello, Stuart, and thank you very much for being on the podcast. Tell us about your career. What got you into this field of pathology? What were you like as a teenager? And I'm going to come up with all the usual cliches about dissecting animals, but how did you come to find this as your career?
I'm not sure where the idea first came from. It just seemed to appear one day. I liked science. I liked medicine. I was interested in the law, but I was always more of a scientific person than a arty person. And it seemed like forensic pathology was the perfect mix of law, medicine, science, deduction for what suited the way my brain worked, and I'm glad to say it was the right decision.
And obviously you would have sat in on many autopsies at the beginning when you were training. Do you remember the first one and how you dealt with it?
I remember the first one I did under supervision. It took me 4 hours to do a very, very basic examination where no medical cause of death could be identified. In that case, the pathologist's role is to identify why somebody died. In this particular case, it was, as is very common in this country, it was heart disease. But it was a very long, drawn-out and painstaking process. I'm glad to say I've managed to get a bit quicker over the years.
When you did that very first examination, what were you looking for?
First of all, at the outside of the body, just to make sure that there's not any injuries that can't be explained. On the inside, you're looking for that evidence of disease, that evidence of something that would cause somebody's death.
Oh, and how would that manifest itself? What would you be doing? You'd be obviously taking tests of various liquids and parts of the body, but talk us through what you would do for those tests.
So the art, the skill of pathology is, it's largely unchanged for a very long time. It is to examine those organs for any structural change, a narrowing of an artery, a rupture of an artery, a blood clot where it shouldn't be. And it's just seeking all of those possible things that can cause death and identifying them. in cases that are more obscure, then you will do toxicology tests and histology tests, looking down the microscope. Sometimes you will do genetic analysis, metabolic analysis, looking at how the body processes things.
For example, when a new case comes in after a sudden death, what is the first thing you do and the first thing that you look for?
The first thing I look for is any evidence of foul play. The classic would be some bruising that can't be explained, particularly if there's bruising, say, to the neck, if there are any pinpoint hemorrhages in the eyes that might suggest strangulation, any of those little signs. And really, in some ways, it's gut feeling as well. Does it look right, or does there seem to be something wrong here?
Why would it not look right? What would be your reasons for thinking it wasn't looking right?
If there are injuries that don't seem to be reasonably explained, if there are injuries in places that you wouldn't expect to see them by accident, you know, we all know that people bump their shins all the time. You expect to see bruising on people's shins as just part of day-to-day life. You wouldn't expect to see bruises maybe on the inner thighs. That might suggest something more sinister. So it's not just what you're seeing, it's where you're seeing it and the context of what you know about that body or about that person.
That particular point you were just making, Stuart, brings us very conveniently to one of the cases I wanted to talk about today, which is the death of Roberto Calvi. I'd really like to pick this case apart. But first, let's refresh our memories on that case by listening to a clip from my audiobook.
So-called open and shut cases are supposed to be the ones that cause few headaches for forensic scientists and police alike. Most suicides are classic examples of this. But sometimes those hasty verdicts can haunt forensic investigators for decades and lead to extraordinary revelations that can turn an entire case on its head. This occurred when I was a young rookie reporter in the early 1980s. I was one of the first journalists on the scene after a man's corpse was found dangling from a nylon rope tied to scaffolding underneath the centre of London's Blackfriars Bridge, one of the UK capital's most iconic ancient bridges. It was the 18th of June, 1982. At first, I couldn't quite believe what I was seeing. Just a few minutes earlier, I'd been sitting in the newsroom of the Mail on Sunday newspaper, about to get myself an early morning coffee. One of my colleagues walked in breathlessly and said there was a body hanging from the bridge just 250 yards from our office. As a keen young reporter, it was a no-brainer. Myself and another journalist virtually ran to the scene. The thing I remember most from that day was the bright orange nylon rope tied to scaffolding under the 200-year-old bridge. I could see it clearly from the moment I crossed the busy embankment running alongside the river. I remember thinking that whoever had staged this disturbing scene wanted the entire world to know what had happened to this man. As I watched from the pavement along the north side of the river, I pulled out my notebook and began writing down the details. The victim was dressed in a grey suit with a white waistcoat and a blue striped shirt. I even noticed he was wearing expensive-looking shoes with leather soles and dark-coloured socks, but didn't have a tie on and, I later discovered, no belt either. Reports said an expensive watch on his wrist had stopped at 1:52 a.m., just over 6 hours earlier. There were two heavy pieces of concrete stuffed in his clothing, which helped explain the weirdly stretched appearance of the clothed body as it hung there almost like a real-life version of the classic modern masterpiece painting, The Scream. Police who attended this grisly scene found a wallet in the victim's jacket pocket containing around £10,000 in various currencies, including Italian lira, Austrian shillings, US dollars and Swiss francs, and a passport bearing the name Gian Roberto Calvini. The passport turned out to be a forgery, and the corpse was identified as 62-year-old Roberto Calvi, president of the Milan-based Banco Ambrosiano, one of Italy's largest banks, with close ties to the Vatican. In the days following, Calvi's nickname of God's Banker leaked out, and it was revealed he'd gone missing from Italy just a week earlier. But why and how this millionaire banker came to die was to become an international mystery that would take many of the world's most distinguished forensic scientists literally decades to try and solve. The Calvi case is one of the most talked about killings inside the world of forensics. I've met numerous scientists down the years who are fascinated by this particular death and who consider its unraveling as the ultimate challenge. The theatrical way the body was positioned, combined with the sinister forces who backed and opposed banker victim Roberto Calvi, made it a unique crime, more akin to a murder in a detective novel than reality. I remember standing on the pavement on the edge of the River Thames, transfixed by the empty scaffolding creaking in the wind, coming off the river after those young police constables had clumsily removed Calvi's body. I was convinced there was no way this man could have simply strung himself up.
Now, Stuart, I know that you have many opinions about this case, but let's start, first of all, with the scene that greeted the first police on the scene and how they reacted, and perhaps explain why at that time it was classified as suicide and how that affected the initial investigation.
So every investigation that we deal with begins with a body. And those first few minutes are absolutely key, because that is when the decisions are going to be made as to whether this is suspicious or not suspicious. And that is going to change how the death is investigated.
And then, sorry, just to reiterate what we were touching on much earlier, this is unique in England, in the UK, isn't it? The way that these two types of deaths are separately dealt with.
To the best of my knowledge, England and Wales is the only jurisdiction that divides deaths into suspicious and non-suspicious, and the standards that are required in those two different sorts of cases are vastly different. So if the decision in the first instance is one that turns out to be incorrect, then evidence is lost, investigation time is lost, suspects can be lost. It's a critical decision that usually occurs before a pathologist even becomes involved.
So suicide in itself could unintentionally hide and help hide a murder. If there was an opinion that something was suicide initially, it would brush over any investigations into it possibly being a murder.
While I do not minimise the effect that suicide has on people and families, if it is deemed to be a suicide, it is not a suspicious death. It is something that someone has done to themselves. And therefore, if that decision is made very early on, then that will skew the entire investigation.
Okay, so let's go back to Blackfriars Bridge, June 1982. The police are greeted with an extraordinarily bizarre scene, a man hanging from scaffolding right off the centre of the bridge. How did he get there? Why was he there? But more importantly and significant at that moment was it was immediately presumed to be suicide. Tell me a little bit about this, please, Stuart.
It is a simple and a much easier conclusion that a middle-aged man who has hanged himself, well, that's going to be a suicide, isn't it? It's called cognitive bias. But it basically means once you've decided what something is, then all you will ever see or all you will ever perceive is things that support your original conclusion.
And that was rife, I would say, up to about 20 years ago inside the emergency services police, even to a certain degree, the forensic business, if you want to call it that. Is that fair enough?
It is fair. And I mean, it still exists. We take more steps to address it. So more collaboration, more discussion, rather than one person being left to make the big decision and then, to some extent, their career potentially hanging on that decision being confirmed to be right.
I personally witnessed the body of Roberto Carlli. I was working on a newspaper overlooking the bridge and was working that morning when his body was found. And I know I walked down to the embankment and I looked at it, and it was the most bizarre sight I think I've ever seen. He looked more like a dummy than a real person, but I guess it was along, you know, at least 200 yards from where I was standing. But more importantly than all of that, I cannot believe that a police investigator would turn up on that scene and immediately assume that it had been possible for him to commit suicide. In other words, to do everything on his own.
I'm glad to say I think we've developed on from that now. Somebody hanging themselves in public who we don't have a background for, I think certainly nowadays would be treated with a lot more caution.
And there's also, on a technical side with the Roberto Carlli case, an interesting aspect in that this was 40 years ago. The body was taken down almost immediately, probably because it was feared that it would upset people in the neighbourhood and whatever, walking around, it's a busy place. And even the scaffolding that he was hanging from was taken down. Now, I think these days, I would hope the body would be left in situ for a bit longer, maybe in some way disguised with some sort of tent so that people weren't having to look at the body the entire time. But it should have been examined at some length in situ, shouldn't it?
Yes, that would be what we would do now. The only time that would change is if there was the possibility that the person was still alive. So preservation of life is the primary concern, even if someone were cut down these days and then confirmed dead, then a lot more attention would be paid to those circumstances, because it's the circumstances, it's everything around the body as well as the body that give you answers.
And in the case of Roberto Carlli, there were a lot of things around the body that were of interest, the main thing being how on earth he could have managed to hook himself up on this rope with the scaffolding. And then there was the very interesting part of this, which was the way his shoes appeared to have been dragged. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yes. So he was a well-dressed man. He had expensive shoes. The forensic science investigation showed that they had marks on them that were in keeping with the heels of those shoes being dragged across a rough surface. That in itself doesn't tell you a lot, but it just starts upping the suspicion. And so it's not just straightforward that he's hanged. It looks as if he's been dragged. The soles of his shoes don't have that transfer of material from the scaffolding, the sort of dirt and paint and rust that they would have if somebody had climbed up. And slowly but surely, the picture starts to build. This is not as straightforward as a very initial impression might suggest to some minds.
But I believe that in the first 10 years, really, following the death of Roberto Carlli, none of these things were really taken that seriously. It took some time, didn't it? I know that his family were convinced he had been murdered, and eventually a murder reconstruction took place in which the body, a body was hung, and everything was done in such a way to try and replicate it. But really and honestly, that's too late, isn't it, Stuart?
It's too late. I believe, if I remember correctly, that an inquest was initially held into the death, and it was held to be suicide. So legally, at that point, without an appeal to, it would have been, I think, the Lord Chief Justice at the time, without it, that is the end of the legal process. There is no further authority. It was really, again, as far as I recall, the family who pushed and pushed and pushed on this and went for judicial review and turned it round. But by then, it's too late. Once that body has been autopsied and once it is buried or cremated, obviously, then your opportunity to get evidence is lost. And everything after that is going to be open to question, because it is trying to interpret things that are no longer there to examine.
Photographers talk about the magic hour when they take a photograph in perfect light, either at sunset or sunrise. What's the equivalent for a pathologist?
It's often called in police investigations the golden hour. So a very, very similar idea. It's those moments where you get the opportunity to do things that you will not get again. It is why a forensic pathologist may spend a very long time, sometimes longer than the autopsy, taking swabs and clippings and looking for fibres, recovering clothing, all of these things, because once they haven't been recovered properly, you can never go back.
And what about, in your experience, when has the golden hour really meant something in terms of one particular investigation?
So the perfect example in my career of the golden hour was the murder of Jane Hings in a little village in Leicestershire. It came to the police as a sudden death of an elderly lady, and the first officer on scene wasn't happy. Her nightdress was pulled up over her face, which he thought was strange. He then decided that was suspicious. That got me involved. That got a forensic autopsy undertaken. And what was recovered was a tongue bar. So a piece of jewellery from a tongue was still on the body. And the one thing we knew full well was that the deceased did not have a tongue piercing. So now we have third-party evidence. Now we have lots of concerns. That tongue bar was sent for DNA testing. It came back with a hit on the database. We went from what appeared to be the sad, common case of an older person simply dying to a murder investigation with a suspect in 2 days. Without that very initial, really astute observation by the officer, all that evidence would have been compromised or lost. And quite simply, it's unlikely that there would have been a conviction.
So it's the exact opposite of Calvi in a sense. And just going back to Calvi for a minute, the theory is that his body was taken to Blackfriars Bridge and strung up to make it look like suicide. Is this feasible? I know you believe it's murder, and I'd love you to tell me a little bit more about why you believe that.
It's very uncommon for people to hang themselves in public, and it is very unusual to see something like this. What you're really wanting to get into now is the really dense detail of what we can see. The ligature on the neck will leave a mark, but if somebody has had a different ligature applied to them previously, then that will also leave a mark. And this is why in hangings, we examine that neck in tremendous detail. Is there any evidence that this is an attempt to cover up what's actually been done?
And intriguingly, there were also two pieces of concrete, one in each pocket. Of course, he could have put them in himself, but it would have been virtually impossible for him to do so before he hung himself. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yes, so two large pieces of concrete. It's a very strange thing in the first place. People who hang themselves wouldn't need to weight themselves down. The weight of the human body is quite sufficient. If he was found at the bottom of the river with concrete in his pockets, then it may lead to a different conclusion. But it's what I refer to in my own idiom as static. If you've got a domestic hanging with a note, with a mental health history, really, you've got quite a clear signal. It's like a radio station playing just right. Once you start getting other things that don't fit, things that don't seem right, it's like you're listening to the radio station with static in the background, and all of a sudden that signal is not as clear as it was. And that's when concerns start to rise. That's when you're thinking, we can't fit this all together in a neat little box. We need to look at it more.
Well, that then suggests that there were mistakes made or things overlooked, at least by the original forensic team. Because although we've talked earlier about all this, the fact is it was declared a suicide. So therefore, the level of investigation was different. But even so, you've looked at this case quite closely. Do you think there are any classic errors?
I think it is the cognitive bias issue. It is a middle-aged man found hanging. Well, middle-aged men hang themselves, and therefore that's what this is. You don't need to look further once you've decided that. You know what happened. I think that's where the problems arose.
And is it also fair to say, Stuart, that as a scientist and as a pathologist, of course you look at the scientific evidence and everything, but you need to sometimes take a step back and look at the exterior effects, i.e. in the case of this man, what he was, who he was, the role, and the fact that the body was exposed in such a public place. It was like a message to people, wasn't it?
Yes, context is everything. And one of the things that's improved over the years is the collaboration between different aspects of the criminal justice system, the police, the pathologists, the scientists. There is a much broader and more holistic approach to a case rather than that very simple initial view. This looks like a suicide, so it's a suicide. Context is everything.
Is there a case you've worked on where this particular issue of context was actually a clincher, that it made such a difference to the way you're either able to look at a case or to actually, it actually influenced the decision that you made?
Yes, there was a case that I dealt with which was in some ways pathologically very simple. It was somebody who had been struck on the head and had developed a bleed on the brain and survived a few days. When they died, there was witness evidence that he had been assaulted, but the scientific evidence could not say that that assault must have caused the bleed on the brain, because with period of survival and the accuracy with which you can determine when a head injury occurred, the scientific answer was it was before, during, or after that assault. But they ran it as a murder trial. I remember saying to the barrister, you do know that I cannot stand up and say that assault definitely caused that. He said, yes, I know. I gave my evidence. I said he got a head injury somewhere around that time. But then they stood up all of the eyewitnesses and all of the evidence of what this man had been doing or not doing. And that went to a conviction, because the context basically took away all the other possible explanations.
The 40 years since the Roberto Calvi death, obviously forensic science has changed a lot. And DNA, for starters, came in, I think, just a few years after his body was found in 1982. What are the big changes that you think have occurred over the past 40 years?
I think probably the biggest change is actually in society rather than in certainly forensic pathology. A stab wound still looks like a stab wound did 40 years ago. The big change is really the amount of information that can be gathered quickly following an incident. So CCTV footage can be obtained, mobile phone data, all of these things add a huge amount to understanding what has happened, down to the level that some murders are literally caught on camera.
What about forensic tools and things that have changed over the 40 years and how they might be now able to help you solve something more easily?
You struck the nail on the head. With DNA, that has been the big game changer. That has revolutionized forensic investigation. We've got all sorts of other things that we now understand can be useful forensically. So forensic botany, looking at pollens, soil. There are even people who can forensically examine feces, poo, and talk about what somebody's eaten, what environment they may have been in to get certain things into their body. So there are so many advances that individually may not mean a lot. Identifying pollen in someone's sinuses in 99.9% of cases may not be that useful, but in that one case, it can be critical.
How is the decision made whether to do these sorts of extensive tests? What influences the decision whether to inspect someone's poo, pollen or whatever?
It's very much the circumstances, and it's very much how obscure the case seems to be. Mercifully, the cases where a young woman is grabbed off the street and killed by a stranger are uncommon. But that sort of case, if you don't know what you're looking for or who you're looking for, then all of these details are going to be very important. If you have, as I did recently, a case where a man is seen to slash another man's neck with a knife on closed circuit television, well, frankly, what they'd eaten or what pollen they may have been exposed to is not going to add to that investigation. So it's very much down to what you have in front of you and what you can think of and the police can think of and the forensic scientists that might add to your knowledge of what has happened in this case.
So I'm going to go back even further now than Roberto Calvi to the case in, I think it was September 7th, 1978, of Georgi Markov. This is an extraordinary and very unique case. One of the reasons I'm going to ask Stuart about it is because he not only examines the dead, but he also examines the living in terms of injuries. Here's an extract from my audiobook to help set the scene.
Markov, a novelist and playwright from Bulgaria, had relocated to England and was living in London working as a journalist and broadcaster for the BBC World Service. He was a stern public critic of Bulgaria's Stalinist regime. On the 7th of September 1978, Markov was waiting near Waterloo Bridge in London to catch a bus when he suddenly felt a sharp pain in the back of his leg, similar to an insect bite. A man seemed to have accidentally poked him with his umbrella as he walked past. The stranger, later described as being heavy-set and speaking with a foreign accent, immediately apologized and briskly walked on. Markov, later that day, recalled the incident to a colleague and his wife, but thought nothing of it. That same evening, he collapsed and was hospitalized, suffering from severe sickness and a fever. By the following morning, Markov had a high fever, rapid pulse, and low blood pressure. His wound was severely inflamed, and his white blood cell count soared. X-rays of his leg revealed nothing, and despite large doses of antibiotics, his condition worsened during the next 2 days. Markov told doctors about the pain in his leg and claimed he must have been poisoned by some kind of toxic dart. No one took much notice of what he said, but 3 days later, he died at the age of just 49. Scotland Yard ordered an autopsy to be conducted on Markov's body. During that examination, a section of the skin around Markov's wound was removed and sent to Dr. David Gall, an expert in poisons based at the top secret government chemical defense establishment at Porton Down in the west of England. Gall found a metal pellet the size of a pinhead with two tiny holes drilled into it. It was clear that something containing a lethal substance had been injected into Markov by a gas gun hidden in his assailant's umbrella. Inside the wound that had been caused by the umbrella being jabbed into his leg was a minute 1.52 millimeter pellet. It was composed of 90% platinum and 10% iridium, with two tiny 0.35 millimeter holes drilled through it. The nature of Markov's demise made bacterial and viral entities unlikely culprits and strongly suggested a chemical toxin had been used. Only ricin, a substance derived from castor beans, seemed to fit the bill. But there was no reliable test for ricin available in the UK at the time. In any case, the body's natural enzyme systems quickly break down ricin, leaving no trace of it, which is precisely why it is one of the most effective and deadly poisons in existence.
So, Stuart, if you'd been the first pathologist to examine the corpse of Georgi Markov, how would you have handled it?
With difficulty is the answer to that one. I mean, this is like, really is like something out of a Cold War John le Carré type story. What we have is a man who says he thinks he's been stabbed, although he didn't have a stab wound as such. Then over the following day becomes fairly non-specifically unwell, and then he dies. So pretty much at that point, you are left with a list of virtually anything to explain his death.
I mean, presumably, they all thought natural causes at the time, because there was no sign of anything. And I think I'm right in saying it wasn't until body samples after Mr. Markov's death, obviously, were sent to Porton Down that a metal pellet the size of a pinhead was found with two tiny holes drilled in it, which contained the poison that killed him.
So this is evidence of the system really working. This is, you know, the polar opposite of Calvi. This is a case where the investigation is saying, well, this is weird and we need to get to the bottom of it. And that decision to take the tissue sample to send it to Porton Down was frankly brilliant.
Well, brilliant or incredibly lucky. I don't want to sound like a cynic here, because there was no evidence then, apart from what he'd said, that anything along the lines we've subsequently discovered even occurred. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. And this is where the open-mindedness of an investigation is going to reap rewards. This is an investigation where they've said, well, actually, there's a lot in the background here and we're just not comfortable. We need to work it out. This is a true suspicious death. You can't say at the start whether this is homicide, natural disease, something in between, but you treat it as suspicious.
Is it possible that if he hadn't died, we might never have found out how he was made ill in the first place?
Entirely possible. I believe that he was x-rayed, but this is such a tiny, tiny, as you said, a pinhead-sized piece of metal. It's not going to be that obvious. So had he not sadly succumbed, I don't think we would ever have known. It would be a strange little story to tell his grandchildren the day I was on Waterloo Bridge and I think somebody stabbed me with an umbrella.
And the other side of it, of course, is that it also suggests that there have been lots of other Georgi Markovs before and since then, doesn't it?
I have no doubt there are ways to kill people which are very subtle and which may not be able to be picked up, certainly with modern science, let alone in the 1970s. I am asked regularly, have I ever missed a murder? And the answer is almost certainly.
Are there ones that you particularly kick yourself about and wished you'd had longer to examine?
It sounds very arrogant, but I'm confident that all the cases I've done, I have identified the evidence that was available to me. But I think there will be cases in that mix where either there's just not enough evidence or it's something that science didn't know about at the time, that there will be a homicide that's been missed. And without that key piece of information about him complaining about his leg, that is just a middle-aged man who becomes unwell and dies.
What in the past have you done in terms of autopsies where perhaps the security services have come and said that they want a certain decision or that you've been put under any pressure? Has this ever occurred to you?
I'm fortunate that I have never been involved in a case where somebody has put pressure on me to give a particular outcome. I think certainly as long as I've been practicing, the boundaries of what an expert pathologist can say are respected. And certainly once you've built a bit of a reputation, people are willing to accept that when you say, I can't tell you that, that that is the answer and that is the correct answer.
Going back to toxicology tests, which were decisive in establishing the cause of Georgi Markov's death, I'm presuming they're not automatically carried out. What circumstances need to occur in order for that to be done?
If a case is non-suspicious, then the pathologist is invited to offer an opinion on the cause of death on balance of probabilities. So what is more likely than not? If they can do that straight after the autopsy, then there will be no authority for toxicology, histology, any other tests usually given. My tick list is, if it's a suspicious death, I need toxicology. I need to know what was in that person's system, because I cannot stand up in court and be told, is it possible he died of an overdose? I don't know, I didn't check. Is it possible that this person who survived 2 days in hospital was given an overdose in hospital by an evil nurse? I don't know, I didn't check. I like to be able to say, that didn't happen, and there's the answer. I would always do it in a case where the cause of death isn't apparent. So more than once, I've dealt with cases where there's no obvious cause of death, there's no particular suggestion of drug use, but when you get the results back, actually, it was drug use. And any potential suicide, I would always take toxicology, because that can certainly, for the investigation of the death, maybe not for myself, assist with what somebody's state of mind may have been. So I have a very low threshold for doing it, because I like to know that the answer is there's no poison here.
So what's the most unusual poison you've ever come across?
The most unusual poison I have come across was taxine from yew seeds. It was a suspicious death, and it was a market gardener. I remember doing the autopsy, and I will fully hold my hands up and say it was one of the scenes of crime officers who said, you know, he had lots of yew bushes and, you know, bits of yew in his van when we found the body, and I think it's poisonous. We went back to the big book of things that kill you and went, actually, yes, taxine in yew seeds is poisonous.
So that was an accidental death. Could you talk us through a little bit more about that?
Yes, so he is found in his van, if I recall correctly, at some motorway services. People don't usually just end up dead in vans next to the motorway, so the police were concerned. Let's just make sure nobody's bumped him off and let, you know, dump the body. So we did the autopsy. Certainly nothing to suggest a third party involved. No evidence of assault or restraint or struggle or anything like that. Very little to actually find looking at the body. And as I said, a scene of crime officer went, he had loads of yew in the van. So that really was the start of understanding why he was dead.
But then his knowledge of that as something to use to commit suicide with takes it on to a different level. If it was accidental that he'd been poisoned, unaware, that something that you yourself wasn't aware was poisonous, then I could understand him more. So he must have researched it in order to use it as a device to commit suicide by.
Yes, and parallel with this, of course, is the investigation into the circumstances and then the evidence that comes out about mental health problems in the past, about financial difficulties, and it all comes together.
How did he administer this poison to himself?
He ate it, the seeds. And I must confess, at the time, I had never heard of that. But it's the only time I've ever seen it in over 20 years of practice.
As they say in the trope, folks, please do not try that at home. That's absolutely fascinating. Just going, finishing off on Markov, the poison used on him, I think it was ricin, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
How would that have attacked the nervous system? And why did it take so long to kill him?
So ricin is a particularly unpleasant chemical, and it's also particularly good for homicides because it causes organ damage that can be look exactly the same as what you might see if somebody is dying of natural causes. And as that damage to your body builds up, you become more and more unwell. Eventually your system can't support itself, and that's the end of you. So it's clever, and it's unusual, and it's rare, and injecting it into somebody, as we can appreciate from the size of the pellet that was used, you don't need a lot of it to have catastrophic results.
So let's go on to Silent Witness, the programme, and also your involvement with other reality-based TV programmes. Silent Witness has faced a bit of criticism in one sense, but in another way, it's deemed as a very good thing because it's made the forensic world more popular and has even led to more people wanting to become forensic scientists. Well, what's your opinion on that?
Yes, I started with Silent Witness in 2013, and I've continued to work with them over the years. I think my job, compared to what you see on the TV, is probably incredibly dull to most people.
What's the dullest thing that you do?
Reading and rereading and rereading my statements to make sure that I have said nothing that a barrister can start wiggling at and make me back down.
You're under that pressure when you do a statement.
Yes, it's getting that the language accurate in a way that it portrays what you need to say without leaving an ambiguity that shouldn't be there, or to make sure the ambiguity is there if your opinion is ambiguous.
So that's a writing skill, in a sense, that you've learned over the years to adapt to, I guess. You mentioned accuracy, which brings me conveniently to our next topic. Let's hear about the importance of accuracy when it comes to shooting a TV crime drama series.
The forensic scientists on Silent Witness are capable of solving a wide variety of clever, intricate crimes. While never rehashing actual true crime stories, the show still manages to provide its audience with a convincingly authentic window into the world of forensic medicine. Many believe this is partly because the writers of Silent Witness have always been given the freedom to come up with fast-moving original plot lines. Some critics, however, have accused Silent Witness of sometimes giving the impression forensic investigations revolve around hunches rather than solid, old-fashioned scientific facts and figures. How many times have we seen that knowing look on current Lyle team leader Nikki Alexander's face when she realizes the significance of some random event she's noticed that we, the audience, wouldn't have thought twice about? As one former BBC producer explained, that's television for you. It's all about making the drama work. Why should accuracy be allowed to get in the way of a good story? Some audience members have been highly critical in recent years about the flashy, arty, overdesigned look of the laboratory at the Lyle Centre, where Nikki Alexander and her team work and spend much of each episode. Many forensic scientists I've spoken to say real-life versions of such laboratories usually have working conditions which are more akin to Victorian times. One ardent fan of the show, who happens to be a forensic scientist, told me, "There never seems to be an instrument out of place in the Lyle Centre, and that does sometimes grate with me. It's just not like that in real life. The producers need to be careful because if they make the Lyle Centre too perfect and sterile, then it might start to detract from the hard work its scientists are involved with. Instead of surfaces that you could eat your dinner off, they should spread a bit of blood and gore around and leave a few old sandwiches and overfull bins around the place. A lot of my colleagues feel the same way as me about this." Actress Amelia Fox has undoubtedly worked hard to ensure her character Nikki Alexander appeals to a wide demographic, although there are moments when she seems somewhat overdressed while performing some particularly grisly post-mortems. As one practicing forensic scientist said, "It does stretch the whole thing a bit to see Nikki dressed to the nines as she cuts open a skull and removes a dead man's brain. But on the other hand, I have to say, the way she does it is actually fairly accurate. She peels back the skin, as one would do, and removes the brain mass in one large chunk. On Silent Witness, you often see organs taken out individually, although it has to be said that us mere mortals in the real world do tend to remove them all from the torso in one session. But I'll give them that one because no doubt the program makers want to ensure they achieve the maximum shock factor from each scene in the lab. Otherwise, it might get a bit boring.
So do you think the TV program Silent Witness strikes a balance between accuracy and entertainment?
I'm firmly in the camp that it is drama, and therefore it is there to be enjoyed. So they write good stories, a clear story, goodies and baddies, and what's happened gets worked out by clever people. And that is well-written drama. What they do, and they're always keen to do, is make sure that the science is right. So if they're talking about what you can tell from a body, they are very set on making sure that that is something that is true. What they'll do is they will accelerate timescales. So, for example, if I need neuropathology, I need expert examination of the brain, that is likely to take about 12 weeks before I get an answer. I'm not concerned that they sort of bring those timescales down to make the story keep moving, as long as the science is right. And the science is there. They have a lot of advisors in a lot of fields who try to make sure that it is as true to life as possible without being tremendously dull.
A lot of the scientific decisions in Silent Witness do seem to be based on hunches, which I guess is not really realistic, is it?
Sometimes. Sometimes you just get a feeling about things, but usually they are much more based on very long conversations between the senior investigating officer, the pathologist, the scientists, the crime scene investigators about what is required in this case, what is going to take this forward. And when I advise on Silent Witness, it's thinking in more or less the opposite way to the way I think at work. So I am told this is the end point we need to get to. Whereas in real life, obviously, we're faced with this is a body, what's happened?
What about the labs, Stuart? They look immaculate in Silent Witness. What's your lab like?
I think I'll politely say far from immaculate.
Which I think is healthy. Surely it's like looking at anyone's desk in an office. It's got to be busy. There's got to be a lot going on, hasn't there?
People find it strange, but given the length of time that I've worked in places like that, it's just my workplace. I will ask somebody if their dog's had puppies, how their children are getting on at school as I'm walking along the corridor. We're not all sort of, oh dear, this is so terrible. Oh, someone has died. It's my job. I've chosen it.
And there's gallows humour, isn't there? Let's face it.
An awful lot of things, I think, taken out of context, would seem incredibly callous and harsh. But it is just human beings trying to deal with what's in front of them.
It's a mechanism, isn't it, to deal with stuff?
I think everyone has their own sort of dark humour about what they do. It's just the nature of our work makes it particularly dark.
What about the actual autopsies that are shown on Silent Witness? They seem quite graphic. Obviously, a real autopsy is graphic in that sense, but do you think they're too graphically portrayed for a television audience?
I'm the wrong person to ask that because I think they are very toned down. I think that's really one for the public to decide. It's what they want in the programme. And I think certainly in the years I've been doing it, it has changed. So when we first started, the very principle of the silent witness being the body, there are only so many things you can find out from a body.
Something that always surprised me a bit is when forensic scientists sit in the interrogation room with suspects. I guess that doesn't happen very often in real life.
It doesn't, and it's certainly something that the programme has deliberately moved away from in the most recent years. And if they want a scene like that, we have to find a way to justify it rather than it just being that somebody happens to be sitting in on a suspect interview.
Very good answer, and it brings us really close to the end. I just want to ask you one last question. lots and lots of people seem to be wanting to become forensic scientists, pathologists, and so on. Here's what I found on the topic while writing my audiobook.
Many in the world of Law and Order believe that Silent Witness has had a positive effect on improving the UK's crime detection rates because so many more people are today working inside crime laboratories, which has greatly improved the efficiency of those facilities. There are more applications for jobs in the forensic sector than ever before. I've personally met three people under 30 working in forensic science in recent months, which seems to prove that point. An assistant inside a laboratory at entry level is usually paid around £15,000 to £20,000 a year. They can eventually end up becoming a reporting officer who could earn in the region of £40,000 a year. Training takes 18 months, and any applicant needs at least a 2-2 in a relevant scientific degree to qualify. Many forensic scientists enter the profession with postgraduate degrees in forensics too. But this thirst for jobs in the forensic sector has rubbed some scientists up the wrong way. They've told me that forensic science students expect to be allowed to participate in actual autopsies before they're anywhere near being qualified to do so. I'm afraid I have to blame that on Silent Witness. The series rarely shows any of the early stages of a forensic scientist's training, said one forensic investigator. It's a pity, because I've encountered so many young people not prepared to put in the hard graft at the boring end of what we do, before they're even allowed a hint of direct involvement in a genuine case. You can't encourage youngsters to hack at corpses until they're properly trained. A lot of these young would-be forensic scientists seem to think they'll be allowed to take part in autopsies within a few weeks of starting training. I always say to them at that stage, welcome to the real world.
Obviously, shows like Silent Witness have helped this recruitment drive. What's your advice to anyone who might be thinking about entering this area for a career?
I think the advice that I give anybody who wants to do forensic pathology is get to medical school. You have to qualify as a doctor before you can do it. And while you're at medical school, you will be exposed to all the different specialties and you may find something that you prefer. For forensic science, which is not my direct field, get a good degree, know your stuff, and then apply it, is the way that most people who I know who've been successful have gone.
Stuart Hamilton, thank you very, very much. It's been a fascinating chat. And thank you for being on the Real Silent Witnesses podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for listening to The Real Silent Witnesses, the mysterious deaths of Roberto Calvi and Giorgio Markov. In the last hour, we've chatted with pathologist Stuart Hamilton about the Calvi and Markov cases. It was interesting to know how instincts can still influence the outcome of an investigation. As Stuart pointed out, sometimes once an investigator has a hunch about the cause of someone's death, he will only see clues that support his original conclusion. This was something that really struck me. Obviously, the views and thoughts I've expressed in this podcast are entirely my own. It's a free world and you can think whatever you want.
Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favourite podcast app so you never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you like the show, we would appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend about it.
For a more in-depth analysis into forensics, check out my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses, which is available at all good stores, including Audible and Apple Books, published by W.F. Howes. Be sure to tune in next week for our latest episode. And remember, the dead tell us everything.